The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is the 11th of April, 2006. This is show number 52, our Qatar race wrap-up. I'm Bob Hayes, your host, and I am joined today by Jim Race from RideOn2.com. Hi, how are you doing, Jim?
I'm doing great. How are you folks doing? Or you folk?
Yes, us, me folk singular, them folks later. So Jim and I are going to talk a little bit about the race in Qatar, which, if you haven't seen it, is a fantastic one. First of all, we're going to talk about qualifying, though, so if you have not yet watched the race, you don't have to worry about turning off the podcast right yet, because we'll talk about qualifying, and then before we talk about any race results, we'll let you know. And we'll try really hard not to give anything away in the qualifying session. I'm pretty sure we can handle that, don't you think, Jim?
I think we can handle that.
All righty. So, I mean, you know, we had on my Friday show, I had the luxury of being able to see the free practice one and two times before I actually recorded the show, since we had the Saturday race and all that business. And we had a pretty surprising free practice one and two sessions, and it just continued on through the Friday free practice three and the qualifying sessions. I think you'll agree.
Absolutely. I was kind of waiting for you to do an extra Friday show and give Chuck another call to see if he'd fill us in.
Yeah, I got an email from him right as I was like editing the last stuff, and it was like, you know, midnight, I'm getting tired, and I was like, okay, and I just sort of stuck it in right in the middle and kind of said, hey, Chuck just got me an email, and so I stuck it in here. I'm sure they were doing some celebrating after Roberts' fastest lap on the Friday, or excuse me, Thursday. But unfortunately, but then they kind of, things didn't quite continue quite so well after that. And
we'll get there. We'll get there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. as far as the qualifying was concerned, I think for the whole of all the practice sessions and the qualifying session, the star of the show was Casey Stoner.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think he had a fantastic weekend. It's so cool to see the newer riders come up and present a challenge, not only to the established leader, and we know who that is, but also just getting out there and kicking butt and trying as hard as they are. And considering what Stoner's situation was on arriving in Qatar after, 48-hour plane flight with delays and with a case of the flu, it was amazing.
Right. No sleep. And he just, he went out there. Randy Mamola on the Eurosport broadcast of the qualifying was going on about that. He had been talking to Stoner, and Casey's like, are these guys actually, are they trying really hard? You know, why, you know, this seems so easy to me. And Randy's like saying, yeah, dude, they're trying. Trust me.
When Mamola was riding, it was all two strokes, and so you had no choice but to try hard. But I think at the four stroke era, I think, you know, possibly with the smoothness of the guys coming up, and it's nice to see the 125, 250 progression kicking back in again, that maybe these guys can pull off some fast laps, at least for a short period of time.
Sure. And they were saying also, and you'll probably know more about this than I do, that the Qatar circuit is suited for the 250 style of riding.
It's a very smooth flowing circuit. I watched part of the 250 race. I haven't had a good chance to go over it again. I tend to watch these things two or three times, but like you, I've been very busy. But I did see a lot of that flowing riding that you commonly see in a 250 race, which is, quick transitions, but then a set and a turn that just flows right through. I think the track is suited to 250 type riding, which is maybe, and then makes you wonder why Edwards didn't do better than he did, but I'm jumping ahead, aren't I?
Yeah, that's cool. In our qualifying session, why don't we go down the list? We'll go ahead. Casey Stoner was on pole. He had a time of 155.683. That's, text is kind of small for my 40-year-old eyes here, or almost 40. So I'm going to bring it up a little bit. And like we said, he was pretty much the star of the show for free practice 1, 2, and 3, always in the top few riders.
Indeed.
Yeah. And then Loris Caparossi, another surprise on the Ducati. I wasn't looking for the Ducatis to do very well here because of the Bridgestones.
And as even the Bridgestone folks were saying, Cutter was probably one of their least favorite tracks, but they certainly proved themselves this weekend.
Right. And they did very well, especially, you know, on the qualifying tires. You're going to get a lap that's somewhat, you know, maybe a bit more exceptional than the other laps. And unfortunately, I don't have the whole qualifying, you know, I don't have every one of Loris's lap times here in front of me, but you know, he turned in a good lap, and he was only, not even 0.04 off of Stoner. Yep. So it wasn't like Stoner had a real comfortable lead going on.
Well, you're only going to get one good lap out of a queue. So he pulled it off at the right time. And not sure if you had a chance to watch it yet, but I watched the whole QP, and it was a big frenzy with about 9 minutes to go, man. Everybody just jamming out there, swapping tires back and forth. And I think watching the QP was almost as interesting as watching the race.
It is. It is, especially, you know, I actually listened to the QP over the weekend more than watched it. I had it going mm-hmm. in the background while I was doing some work outside on my motorcycle. And you hear the commentary, and when you get...
Yeah, you hear the voices start to raise and raise and raise.
Yes, exactly. and I was listening to the Eurosport one, so I had Randy Mamola and going on and passing on these little nuggets of knowledge and everything, and it was, you know, it was good. It is fun. It's neat to watch. So third place on the grid, Tony Elias, also on a tear for, you know, doing very well considering, Tony's been a little
not exceptional, but you have to remember we're only two races in.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, overall his is a little uneven is maybe what I was looking for. Last year was kind of like, well, I yeah. sort of, you know, but then last year, I think he had other handicaps going on, being on the Tech 3 team and the Dunlops and just a variety of other things. I think he's going to blossom a lot better here on the Fortuna Honda.
I think so.
Yeah. So that there's our front row. Second row, fourth place on the grid, Nicky Hayden. Fast guy on the Repsol Honda there. Had a 155.793. He was about a tenth off of Casey Stoner. And
but,
I don't know.
But six 100ths off of Elias. So the factory Honda team was behind the satellite factory team, or satellite Honda team.
Right, and both of them just were behind the customer bike team. Because LCR.
Indeed.
Yes, that's, and Casey Stoner riding for LCR, for Honda LCR, they basically, you know, they lease a motorcycle from Honda, and it's like, you know, here you go. And they don't get a lot of support ongoing throughout the year from Honda, like the factory team certainly does. You probably know more of the details on that one there, Jim. But it's
my understanding that it's not as far flung as you might think. When you lease a motor from or a bike from one of the major manufacturers, they are there. They are there for you. They're there at every race. There are mechanics that. Come and talk to you about things, and if you need to get in the motor, they will be there to assist you and make sure you don't do anything wrong because it's their name on the engine. So,
right, but he's not going to be getting any trick new bits or anything like that.
No.
But then also the trick new bits don't always make you go faster.
As we've seen. Yes. In fact, Rossi on Sunday, yesterday, was testing the 2005 bike just for comparison again. So,
okay.
I keep getting ahead. Go
no,
ahead.
That's good. You're doing, this is good. We want a free-flowing conversation here, and we don't have a whole lot of time to spend on each segment, unfortunately. Fifth place on the grid, Danny Pedrosa, teammate Nicky Hayden, had a good qualifying lap there after a somewhat uneven qualifying or entire the whole practice session for him. I thought was a little uneven, and after Jerez, which understandably he did so well at being, you know, a home race and everything. But I was kind of thinking, oh my God, he's, you know, just gonna, wow, blow us away. And I mean, he still, I'm not saying the guy did crappy or anything, but it's like, okay, this is a little bit more like what I was expecting, you know, a month or two ago. I wasn't quite expecting some guy to darn near win his very, very first GP.
I think all of us that watched the first race were kind of blown away with the finish. And had skewed perceptions as to what the rest of the season was going to be like. And I think that all was snapped back to reality after the end of this weekend.
Right. And when you...
I'll leave it at that.
Hindsight 2020, like I said, you know, he was riding in Jerez. It's basically a home circuit for him. And, uh, you know, he's in front of the Spanish crowd. It's, there was, you know, not only a lot of pressure, but also he had that home circuit advantage, I think, going on. And those things contributed, along with, of course, you know, gobs of natural talent and a 50-pound weight advantage. So,
yep.
Sixth place to round out row two on the grid, Valentino Rossi. A little low down on the qualifying grid for Rossi. I mean, he's not the best qualifier, but he typically likes to be a little higher up than sixth.
Well, you got to remember that sixth on the grid is still a second row.
That's true.
And that's pretty damn close to the front.
Yeah, especially when you're looking at, let's see, what's his gap time there for back to Rossi. You're still looking at less than 0.4. Yep. So your top six riders are covered by 0.4 of a second. That's very close.
That's a small blanket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Sete Gibernau, seventh on the Ducati. The Ducatis also, like I said, did very well. You know, Caparossi second, Sete coming in seventh, did quite well. I don't have anything else going on to say about Gibernau. Jim, over to you.
I thought he had a productive weekend.
Okay.
We'll leave it at that. I think he had a good weekend.
Okay, cool. eighth place, Colin Edwards. Also, you know, doing very well considering the disaster of a weekend that they had at Jerez. I mean, it was just, Colin was really happy to get out of there. I know that. And I think Rossi was as well.
So, think so. Eighth was a good spot. And again, you know, he's right there. So.
Okay. And then ninth, Shinyan Kano on the Kawasaki, continuing to impress.
In qualifying.
in qualifying, yeah. But I think Kawasaki's come a long way, though, since...
I think what they need... Well, yes and no. I think they have come a long way. I think that they have a way to go still, and I don't know if it's the bikes or the riders at this point. There's a small part of me that would like to see Olivier Jacques instead of Depunier, but that may be more of a personal past riding performance preference. But I think having a stronger teammate might help Shinya come up with better results. I don't know if they're a great fit together.
Yeah, that's possibly true. When was the last time we saw Shinya on the podium?
You know, Pop Monkey the top blurt that out.
Yeah, exactly. I can't. I'm not that kind of guy. I know that last year, I think his best result was a fifth, I think.
I think it was around there. Yeah. You'll probably get some email on this.
Probably. Yeah, exactly. But we know Olivier Jacques was on the podium in Shanghai in a mind-boggling, oh my God, where'd he come from performance? And
yep. Yeah, that was great. Yeah. And frankly, I think he's a great personality for GP. I'd like to see him back.
Really? Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of interviews with him or anything like that to know a lot about his personality. So,
mm-mm. And, you know, it was kind of funny. There was a rumor before this race that with Depunier, who qualified way down in 15th, that with his hand injury from the last race, or it was practice, I believe it was, Biaggi was going to replace him. It was a classic internet rumor, which turned out not to be true, but had people stirring for at least a day or so. Not that we'll propagate any of those rumors, but it's still kind of fun to think about.
It's always fun to propagate rumors. I make them up.
We like telling the truth.
Yeah.
Maybe mix it with a bit of spice. But
there you go. Yeah, Max must not have got my email. I sent him an email saying, hey, how about an interview? And, you know, haven't heard back yet. We're working on that, though.
Yeah. It'd be interesting if he's still down in Southern California. I've got some feelers out for folks down there if they happen to see him to have him give us a jiggle and maybe we can get him on.
That'd be awesome. That'd be very, very neat.
As you well know, trying to track down successful racers to interview is very difficult.
Oh, yeah. They're,
they're busy.
Right. They are very, very busy. And I know that MotoGPOD is, you know, I mean... Yeah, I know what it is. I'm happy with it. I think that I do a fairly good job. But also, on the other hand, I know that I'm also basically some guy, you know, just a hobbyist doing this out of his bedroom. And you sort of lack a little bit of credibility. And that actually brings me real quick plug for the Red Bull US Grand Prix.com weekly dispatches by Chris Johnham from Road Racer Podcast. And I meant to mention this in my intro. He's got his second episode up and he's getting Nicky Hayden and John Hopkins on every episode, which, you know, he's got a big leg up on me because it's officially sponsored podcast from Red Bull, and he's the editor of Road Racer X magazine, and so on and so forth. But whatever, if you haven't checked it out yet, Red Bull US Grand Prix.com, but don't leave MotoGPOD, right? And, okay, onto the qualifying, continuing 10th spot, Kenny Roberts Jr. on the KR211V, as it's known.
And down from his great running effort during free practice, but still a good time. He was still way faster than he was in that. So, I mean, the entire, if you look at this, the entire qualifying effort was less than 4 seconds, or a little bit, I'm sorry, a little bit over 4 seconds covering the field. So exactly. That's not bad, considering last year it certainly wasn't that. It might have been closer to that if you took WCM out of the mix. Not that anything against WCM, but they just had a bike that wasn't up to par. So,
right, they sort of skewed the percentages and averages and things. Yeah, but and also, and now that we're down to 10th spot, and we haven't even got to 6/10 off of pole, so the top 10 riders are all covered by 6/10, which is that's very close.
It is close, especially on a track like that. It's a good sized track.
Exactly. Yeah. What? Yeah. Almost 3.5 miles, 3.4 miles, yep. Something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Real quick through the rest of the qualifying, not to cut any of these guys short, but we want to talk about the race. So 11th spot, Chris Vermeulen on the Suzuki, faster than teammate John Hopkins at, in Qatar, interestingly enough. 12th spot, Marco Melandri on the other Fortuna Honda, who has been somewhat falling off, something's happening a little bit with Melandri, both at Jerez and here. And,
I agree. We'll talk about that later.
Okay. Yeah. John Hopkins, 13th spot on the grid, on the Suzuki, had a difficult weekend. We'll talk about that later too. things went great in the race though. Carlos Checa on the Tech 3 Yamaha, again, preseason testing. I love Checa. He's back. He's awesome. He's doing great. And now that we come to the season, he's not sucking. He's not doing bad, but he's doing about what I thought he would do. And, you know, I knew the Dunlops would be a bit of a handicap. I knew that being on the second string Yamaha team is also a bit of a handicap. So, you know, he did okay. He's in 14th on the qualifying lap. He's 1.6 seconds off pole. The times start taking fairly big jumps here.
Yep.
Comparatively, 15th, Randy Dupunier on the Kawasaki. And I believe he had some kind of horrible crud sickness or something where he just wasn't quite all together all weekend long.
Pretty bad hand injury.
Yes.
And I think it was throttle side. I'm not sure. I think it was his right hand.
Okay.
And that's a racer saying that, throttle side.
Right. And that's going to affect your times. You know, you're working under a handicap like that in one way or the other, and it's going to show. And he's still, he was 2.1 seconds off pole. So, you know, it's a little bit bigger gap, but it's not insanely big. 16th, Makoto Tomita. But he wishes he was still on those Bridgestones. And 17th, James Ellison, which is nice for James not to be last for a change. And then speaking of last, 18th place, Alex Hoffman on one of the Dantin Ducatis, and his teammate in 19th, Jose Luis Cardoso. So that's the qualifying session. It was good. If you get a chance to go to like MotoGP.com or whatever and download the things they had. Did they have the commentary by Nick Harris on the one on MotoGP.com, Jim?
During qualifying?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. They were interesting. I remember last year, most of the time, they didn't have any conversation during qualifying, which I kind of liked. But they're doing it now this year. It's like you said, I guess it's good for working on your bike if you can at least listen to what's going on.
Right. Or, you know, like I also at work sometimes, you know, I'll just sort of stick it on and actually put a piece of paper over the screen so that anybody that looks in doesn't think, and I don't get tempted, you know, to sit there, blown an hour watching qualifying, you know,
and just to have it in the background. Half of my workmates are motorcycle riders and former racers, so I kind of get away with that.
Yeah, I can too, but it's just, you know, if I spend an hour and a half a day working on watching qualifying instead of working on stuff, and I can listen better than I can and work better than I can watch and work.
Understood.
So... So, alrighty, there's a real quick rundown on the qualifying. We've got a few minutes left that we can talk about the race. So, like I said before, if you have not watched the Qatar GP, you owe it to yourself to watch it, for starters. And if you're the kind of guy like I am, and I think that like Jim is, that really likes to be able to watch a race without a spoiler, now is the time for you to pause the show and find that race somewhere. It's being rerun on Speed TV probably by the time after you've heard this. But tomorrow, Tuesday at... I think it's 12 noon Pacific. It's being rerun on Speed TV.
Probably so. If you don't have a DVR right now, I don't know how you can survive your motorcycle racing season.
Exactly. The DVR is God's gift to watching probably all sports, but my, you know, the only sports I'm really interested in are racing. And I'll tell you, it's the best thing. You know, you see something where, oh, wow, you pause it. The phone rings, you pause it. It's just, oh, I love it. Yep. So
that and the pesky commercials. Oh, there they go.
Yeah, sorry, there they go. But I can watch the ones that I choose to watch. You know,
absolutely. And of course, there are certain ones that we like to see.
Sure, there are, and I support those. Actually, I got teased a while ago for buying Red Bull. You know, and I said, well, you know, the taste and stuff. And I said, but look, these guys sponsor what I like. You know, Formula One, MotoGP, just about every racing series on the planet. I'm going to buy their stuff. Okay,
not in that order, of course.
Right. All right, moving on. Exactly. Moving on to the race. Okay. Wow, where do we want to start with the race? Because it was.
Well, they had these red lights, and then they went out.
Yes, that's exactly, and they're off. But first of all, there was a guy. Did you see how windy it was? The guy.
Oh, it was incredible.
Yes,
with a red flag. Yeah, I thought the poor guy was going to get blown into the front rear.
Mm-hmm. And on the 250 race, it looked like it was even worse. I mean, he was. Yep. You could see he was really straining to hold that flag, and he's holding it in both hands. He walks in front of the riders, and I mean, that thing is like a sail.
And, having personally held a red flag in front of the grid, I can tell you that those winds were horrendous. And given, I mean, I haven't even thought about this up to this point, but I would have to think that given the length of that front straight, that aerodynamics probably played a big or halfway decent part in this race.
Yeah, I think it must have.
In fact, I'm surprised. You'll note that if you ever watch Phillip Island GP races, that you'll see a lot of these guys have their fairings drilled.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I'm surprised that I didn't see any of the drilled fairings at this race. Because I looked through a whole bunch of pictures and I didn't see any. Maybe they just weren't expecting. Of course, they weren't expecting rain that morning either. And it's the middle of the desert in Qatar. So
they had rain Saturday.
They had rain early Saturday morning. Yes, they did.
Well, I didn't even know that. And look at the World Superbikes had horrible problems with rain there.
Yep.
This year. How weird. There's somebody's trying to sell something.
Gotta water that artificial turf.
Yeah, there you go. Try and turn some of the sand, wash it off the track. So in any event, though, the race was a flag-to-flag. You know, there was none of this sort of, oh, the slow bit in the middle. I mean, it just it started off good, and we had Stoner on pole, got the whole shot, was leading, started opening up. I mean, at one point, he had pretty fair.
It was about maybe a three-quarter to one-second gap. And if I remember correctly, he led the first nine laps while both Hayden and Rossi were valiantly chasing him, neither of them seeming to make up any significant ground until...
So, yeah, Rossi passed Stoner for the lead there on lap 10, actually, it was.
Indeed.
So, right, sort lap of, 10. It was actually at the end of lap 9, beginning of lap 10, because I believe he passed him going into turn 1, if I recall correctly.
Yes, he did. He passed him on the brakes going into turn 1.
One thing I did notice about the coverage, was that we had a beautiful onboard at that time from Stoner. Then we, and we were going into that back complex of the turn 11, the big, long, left-handed, huge sweeper that leads into the three rights in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a great onboard. It's like, oh, cool, an onboard, let's watch that, you know, and everything. And Nick Harris was being, you know, relatively not excited. And, you know, I mean, excited is good, but, and then we cut to a commercial, which fine. I live with commercials. I understand. I live in the United States, but when we came back, they basically showed the pass. It's like, okay, you guys cut out the whole second half of this lap. And obviously Rossi had made up a lot of ground because he was a ways behind Stoner when we cut to that commercial. And then all of a sudden now he makes the pass going into turn one.
And here's the deal, and for all you folks out there, if you're that bad of a junkie for road racing, and I know that I am, you're going to do what I did. I read the spoilers before I even watched the race, which I hate to do sometimes, but then I watched the quick race on MotoGP.com in the morning, and then watched it again on Sunday. So you don't have the commercials, because, frankly, there's no way that you can take a race like that was this weekend and put commercials in it and cut out any part of the race and still have it be what it needs to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
if they do have the luxury that they're editing a race that has already happened. It's not like a live race where it's like sooner or later you got to go to a commercial and you take your chances that something's going to happen. You know, they watch this race, they can choose when to cut it up, and they can also choose, and at Jerez, they did a pretty good job of this, to come back and you haven't missed much. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You just cut it a commercial, come back, and it's more or less the same place. But what they're
the first commercial that they ran, and I actually watched it, I think they lost maybe 50 yards of the race. But then I noticed later in Speed Channel that they were cutting up a little bit more.
Right. Like I said, I understand the commercials. That's fine. But they also wanted to make time at the end for some of the post-race. And that led me to believe, and I guess we can give away, you know, people who are listening now have heard the race, so I'm not going to spoil it. But that all led me to believe that Hayden was going to win because it looked like there at the middle that I honestly thought he was going to, just from watching the race, oh my God, you know, he's passed Rossi for the lead for a while, which I don't recall other than, well, actually Laguna Seca, he never actually passed Rossi. He just stayed in front of him the whole time. Yep. I can't remember the last time that Hayden passed Rossi for the lead, if he has yet.
That's a good point. I don't know if I can think of him doing that unless maybe Rossi went wide in a corner, but it was never this series of back and forth that we had, like we had here.
Right, the actual challenging racing, riding the guy's rear wheel and manages to stuff it under him kind of thing. And it was a well-executed thing. It was beautiful to see. And then Rossi, you know, they turned it on and came back, and that was also fun to watch. And they, what was I leading? Oh, and so then when they started doing the whole commercial thing where it's all of a sudden you lose half a lap, I figured that they're trying to save up time because that we're going to see Hayden win and they want to have the Hayden interview. And oddly, you know, at the end, Hayden didn't win and they didn't even show on Speed TV a lot of the interviews. It was mostly just the Nick Harris and Mark, whatever his name is, color guy, sidekick that, you know, chattering away. And I was a little surprised that they wanted to save up so much time for the post-race, which I like. I love the post-race and the pre-race. I wish they'd set aside an hour and a half for the damn MotoGP, but
yeah,
but whatever. So,
we could gripe all we want about the television coverage, but I think it is what it is. And unfortunately, at least here in the United States, there is enough of a, you know, population to support road racing like people like you and I and everybody else out there would like to see.
Exactly. And I mean, to be honest, it sounds kind of sappy and sucky-uppy and all that, but I feel fairly fortunate that we have what we have.
Absolutely.
Because MotoGP.com is all well and good and watching little tiny crunchy internet movies and stuff. But to me, you know, I've got that damn 37-inch TV out there and a nice chair in front of it and good sound and all that. That's where I want to see the race.
It's true. It's true. Well, said on rideon2.com, I said, I can remember when I used to go buy the VHS tapes of the race 3 months after the movies. So after the race ran. So yeah, there you go.
Exactly. So we shouldn't complain too much. Thank you, Speed. You're my life.
Yes.
They're listening. Okay. Continuing on through the race, Rossi took the lead in lap 10. And like I said, other than being passed by Hayden on lap 19.
He going into the first turn as well.
Right. And other than that, he kept the lead the whole time. Stoner started sort of dropping back after that initial first 10 laps of just greatness. And I won't say he dropped back to mediocrity or anything like that, but he said it himself. He was just, as much as anything, his condition from being sick, from the jet lag catching up, from everything else, he just could not push it quite as hard through the whole race distance. And it started affecting him.
Considering, I think he had a fine performance.
No, I'm not saying that in the to take anything away from the guy. It's just you know, it's not like I was thinking during the race, his tires started going off or something. But judging from comments afterwards, I don't think that was the case. And Stoner also is confident enough in himself to admit that. Although I guess in some ways, you know, he's still, you know, blaming the sickness, you could say, but I don't think it's any kind of lack of talent. And I think we're going to see good things from Stoner. In fact, the Phillip Island race should be really exciting.
Should be a cracker, as Nick would
yes,
say.
Yes, exactly. And we had in third place on the finish, which, because coming up from staying in the top five the entire time, but Loris Caparossi managed to finish third.
Which I believe keeps him in the top of the points.
Yes, he would have 25 and 16, 41 points. Rossi's and Hayden will have a third, 16 and 20, so 36 points, yes. Yep. And Rossi is, you know, both of them are leading Rossi, which is, you know, kind of cool for them to say, huh?
That should make for some interesting races down the road. I think it's going to be a great season. I really do.
I do too. And we've got the Turkey Istanbul race coming up here in a few weeks. And that one, I like that track. That's the best of, to me, the best of the Formula One turned into MotoGP type tracks that we have.
I think so too. I've actually seen both onboard laps from a Formula One car and from a GP bike there. And it's an interesting comparison because the elevation changes there are pretty spectacular, and especially the way that the track's laid out. Very, very cool track.
Yeah, it is a good one. I don't know if they've named that spectacular corner yet, the one with the, like, 8 apexes or whatever the hell it is.
Oh, yeah.
Other than calling it Turn 8. Alrighty, we're back. We took a little momentary break, one of the wonders of podcasting. We're not live, so we can do that. But where did we leave off?
Nearly live.
Nearly live. We're live at our desks. So we left off what we were talking about, Caparossi coming in third. And and so in fourth place, we had Sete Gibernau.
Which you got to give him some props. I mean, I said it before, but I think he had a good weekend. Yes. I think that that's a solid result, and he should build on it.
Yeah, I agree. I think he did very well too. We didn't see a whole lot of him during the race. There was, you know, the coverage that you get, you know, the director is deciding what to show you, and the stuff at the front was going on so much that we saw that, although they did momentarily go back, well, not momentarily, actually for a hell of a long time, they were showing the Pedrosa Melandri.
Yeah, that was a great battle.
It was a good race in itself.
Yep. You know, it was interesting. I was watching Gibernau, and I saw him do something incredibly smart towards the end of the race. And you could see it, I think, with about 3 or 4 laps to go. And I almost thought that he was either having a problem or he'd run out of gas or run out of physical gas. But I could actually see him ease up when he was behind Stoner. And I watched him doing that, and I said to myself, he is either letting the tires cool down or he's doing something wise. He's going to take a stab at Stoner at the end, which is exactly what he did.
So, yeah, he's got the experience and everything. And that's, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You just sort of let Stoner lead for a while and then pass him when you can. And yeah, you passed him on lap, what, 20?
I believe it was lap 20. Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, he did. He ran a good race. You know, there was a fair gap between the leaders and him because the top three were covered by only about a second or something like that, I think. And clicking around all these different documents that I got open here. Yeah, well, Nicky Hayden less than a second behind Rossi, and then Caparossi 1.5 behind Rossi. So
yeah, there's no doubt that Rossi wicked it up at the end, and that was his traditional style. He's always saving something for the last lap. Although, interestingly enough, his fastest lap was on lap 3, which I was a little surprised by when I saw those stats. I would have thought it would have been more towards the end of the race, and I think at Jerez during qualifying when he was on his race tire, he was actually running his fastest laps on his race tire toward the end of the stint. So the guy knows how to manage tires, no doubt.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's no doubt about it. He's a wonder to watch in general.
And something was also was kind of interesting. If you caught any of the extended broadcasts. When he went through his post-race fun, doing his burnouts and playing with the camera and whatnot, it took a long time for him to come into where they basically get the bikes and they sort of confiscate them so they can look them over and they congratulate their teams. The first thing that I saw when he pulled in was one of the Honda techs, a Repsol tech, go around behind Rossi's bike and look down at his tire.
Really?
And I was, yes, indeed, and I was thinking, because there was somebody had brought up questions about tire warmers going on bikes right after a race. And in club racing, which I do, people will do that to extend the longevity of their tires. But Rossi's team, the next time I saw the shot, he had a tire warmer on. And I had to wonder at that point if his little gravel trap tour off to the camera and his burnouts, if some of that isn't somehow related to let's fry the tire before we get it back so nobody can garner any information from it.
You know, it could be. You just never know. And also they want to pick up as much weight as possible too.
True. Very true.
Yeah. To make sure that you make the weight. Because the bikes are ridden into park for me, and that's when they're weighed at the end of the race.
And those boys certainly aren't losing any pounds or gaining any pounds when they're out on course. Hmm.
No way. Excuse me. Sorry, caught me there, Miss Swallow. but yeah, no, definitely not. And I also noticed the tire warmers because we just had that with Mark Vandement on the Friday show about the tire warmers and. And, you know, I knew what they did it, but I sort of did pay extra attention. And, yeah, sure enough, they got tire warmers, and Rossi's were yellow, and I think the other teams were black.
Yeah, they're quite well color coordinated.
Oh, yes. You know, this is the style master. We had Sete Germanau fourth place. And then in fifth place, like you said, running an excellent race, having an excellent weekend all weekend long was Casey Stoner. Yep. Fair gap, you know, Sete Germanau was pretty much by himself in fourth at that point. He was, you know, 3 seconds behind Caparossi, and then about another 3 seconds behind him was Stoner. So Sete Germanau crossed the finish line in a fairly lonely fourth. But, you know, Stoner came in fifth, an excellent race for, you know, he's a rookie this year. It's a second MotoGP race. He's going to do well.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
And I think he did a, you know, considering all the drawbacks with the I didn't get a lot of the details other than being trapped in airports for 48 hours, pretty much is all, you know, the short version that I heard, that he just had the flight from hell to get a relatively short distance. You know, he was flying from Europe to get to Qatar. And I guess just one thing after another, he spent you know how it is when you spend time in an airport and it sucks.
I read somewhere about him sleeping in a duty-free shop.
Oh, so, and that kind of thing. So it's he did not have a very good trip to get to Qatar. And then in sixth place, Danny Pedrosa, once again, about 3 seconds back of Stoner. So Stoner had opened up a good lead on Pedrosa. I think that being the two rookies to watch there, you're going to see a fair amount of battling back and forth between those two guys.
Interestingly enough, the top three bikes as far as speed goes were all Hondas, and they were all the rookies, Pedrosa, Elias, and Stoner. And with Ducati typically having the roost in the top speed wars, they were a fair bit down. And now Pedrosa, with his weight, obviously is going to probably be obtaining a little bit more, but a good solid performance for the Hondas on top, and especially considering LCR's second tier status too.
Right. Yeah, really, I mean, you know, it's not like that's a mean thing to say. That's sort of, you know, they have to be comparatively underfunded. You know, they're a smaller team. They only have the one rider. It's first year in MotoGP. They're a fairly young team all around. It's not like,
absolutely.
Actually, talking about Pedrosa's weight, I wish I could remember which corner it was he was coming off of, but he was actually...
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Did you see the wheel lofting? I mean, he...
Yeah, whacked the throttle open at full lean, back end stepped out, and he just kept it that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of, front wheel was off the ground for a long ways, which, you know, normally you're definitely trying to keep that front wheel down, and he just doesn't have the weight, you know, so it's like, back off or what?
I saw Stoner do the same thing after he got passed by Rossi. Yeah. And I think it was the same corner, too. So it's not like these guys aren't going for it.
Oh, no. Yeah. Well, Stoner's no giant himself.
True.
Yeah, I don't know his weight and height and all that off the top of my head. I don't think he was on that list that we saw on Superbike Planet the other day. But, you know, all these guys are small. They're jockeys. Yeah. I was actually surprised to see, because I don't remember, maybe, you know, I've seen these numbers or something, but it just didn't click or whatever. I didn't realize that Rossi was so much taller. You know, 5'11 is quite tall. He's very thin. Okay.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting. Back to the race. Seventh position, Marco Melandri on the Honda. Again, just just kind of ran a race. You know, he was in front of Pedrosa for a long ways. He and Pedrosa were doing a very good race, and Pedrosa kept trying it on, and Melandri would hold him off, and you could see the coming into the corners and everything when they did focus on those two guys back in, was sixth and seventh, and I believe for a while were they in seventh and eighth for a while when they were
in seventh and eighth,
and that was good to watch.
I think I'm going to give Melandri at this point. It's probably a little bit too soon, and people might get in grief for it, but the underperformer of the year so far. Look what he did last year, at the end of last year. And we haven't seen anything that really lights my fire from him this year. I don't know what's wrong. Hopefully it isn't that picture of him from MotoGP.com wearing only his boots. But for those of you that haven't seen that,
though.
That's posted somewhere on RideOn2.com. It's a little bit scary.
I actually saw it. Yeah, it's an ad for, what is this, AGV or Alpine Stars or whatever his company is.
I think so. And, my comment was, my eyes are burning.
Yes. We don't need to see that. And he actually had some troubles coming to grips all around with the 2006 model of the RC211V, which I think that they all have.
I think so too.
Yes. Through all of the testing, the preseason testing, Hayden was pretty much here. You ride the 2006 bike because you're the development boy, and everybody mm-hmm. else is out there on the 2005 bike and basically, you know, doing better than Hayden most of the time, while Hayden got caught up with the development work, which in some ways might have handicapped Hayden a little bit, but in some ways I think it would be beneficial. He had the head start. These other guys were, you know, riding
always a step behind.
Exactly. And in effect, riding the lame duck bike. And Melandri actually rode the 05 bike at Jerez. And then for this race, it was the story I heard was there's no more spares, but whatever reason it was, he's on the 06 bike. And I believe though it was a little bit different than Hayden's 06 bike. Who knows? You hear so many rumors, and you can never, with Honda, it's all so secret and special anyway that you just never really know.
Yeah. Frankly, Honda being the former, I know this is horrible to say, but the former dominating team in GP, I would like to hear a little bit more information out of them. But I can understand some of their hesitancy to do so. And especially given the corporate culture that they have. Bless you, Honda, I love you, but I think a lot of the other teams are a little bit more forthcoming, both in information to the public and information to the riders and teams.
Right, I think that's true.
I'll leave it at that before I get in trouble.
No. I've heard of listeners from all over the place, but not yet from anybody from Team Honda. So if you're out there, drop us an email.
Absolutely.
Any of the Honda teams. And they're notoriously difficult to get on like their press release list and stuff like that too, which I noticed you had some problems on Ride On 2 that were coming.
Not anymore.
Recently. No, not anymore. Yeah. But all the other teams, yeah, sure. You know, Honda, no. Not that we just want to sit around and read press releases. Okay, and after Melandri, we had in eighth position Tony Elias on Melandri's teammate on the other Fortuna Honda on the Michelins. And way, way back, he was 8 seconds behind Melandri almost.
It was interesting. I was kind of surprised to see him that far back, but I still think it was a solid performance combined with what he did at Jerez. I think he's in great shape for the season.
Yeah, he's doing okay. I think that after qualifying as high as he did at this race, he didn't get a very good start, and he just sort of faded off.
True.
So
it's no fun racing by yourself either.
Yeah, no, it would make it much more difficult because you don't really have, you don't have that to judge against and so yep. forth. Yeah, it's hard to push yourself. Ninth position, Colin Edwards.
Who can't be satisfied with that.
No. And yeah, it's got to be hard being Colin. I mean, you see him in the interviews and he says things like, well, you know, Valentino's Valentino, you know, sort of a thing. And he has to be, you know, the team guy, and that's cool. He's being the team guy. And you're not going to say, what can he say about Valentino Rossi anyway? But I mean, he's, you know, it's got to be hard to be, you want to talk about the, well, the middle child syndrome without a younger brother even. I mean, it's just, it's got to be rough.
I think Colin's independent enough that he doesn't feel like he's that way. But I know that from watching him over the years that he's competitive enough that he doesn't like coming in second and mm-hmm. he doesn't like coming in third, just like any of these guys. So for him, I would see this as a sign that he needs to resolve some issues either within the team or within himself and get back up to where he can probably run. Yeah. You know, we talk a lot about this superbike guy is not doing well in GP, et cetera, et cetera. I think Colin's one of the people that can overcome that fairly well, and there have been some in the past. So I look for better things from him this year.
I agree. And Colin's got a 250cc history, doesn't he?
Yep.
Yeah, so he's – and you know, he's done well in the past. I look for – he'll be on the podium a few times this year. He'll – who knows? You know, maybe we'll see him win one.
If there's one thing that I can draw from the first two races of the year is that I have no idea how the rest of the year is going to go.
Oh, yeah. Well, I said it before, and this time it seems like Yamaha's having a little bit of troubles. Honda's having a little bit of troubles. Kawasaki and Ducati are both solving problems. Suzuki is halfway. Team Roberts, obviously. You know, so it's compressing the field. So they're all, you know, wow. And then the talent has always been there.
Yep. And whoever figures out their bike issues first, regardless of probably the rider that's on it, is going to start making some headways soon.
Exactly.
And my guess is that Edwards and the bike haven't come to terms yet. We know Rossi and the bike haven't yet, but he has the ability to ride around that. Whereas Colin, you know, still probably in the midst of changing his style to suit the bike and what he feels he has to ride as, hasn't yet.
Yeah, that's very reasonable. And, you know, it's got to be difficult there. You know, like you said, Colin's changing his whole riding style to try to suit the bike. And you've also got the motorcycle itself in a state of change and the tires. And as we've heard about the Yamaha, that it's infinitely adjustable. And if you let people start tinkering, the next thing you know, you lose your head. You don't know where you know, what was good, you know.
You've instantly adjusted yourself out of contention.
Exactly. So, okay, 10th position, Kenny Roberts Jr. You know, a solid performance. I mean, he's doing okay.
His times were good. I did note that he faded a bit towards the end of the race, and if you look at his lap times, you can see the same thing. He did great. I think he had a good weekend. I think that probably pumps a lot of enthusiasm and confidence into the team.
Right, and it's a building process, and you know, it's not like they're out there against guys that are not extremely tough competitors all around. You know, talent wise, money wise, and equipment wise, and all that, and for the fact that they're so far ahead of factory teams, you know, be it sure Kawasaki and Suzuki, but nonetheless factory teams. That's a good sign.
They were, you know, give it this, they were the second to last Honda. But that being said, if you look and see where, if you compare this to the nightmare that they had, you know, in October and November, this is awesome.
Yes, exactly. I agree. And and there's only more. They've got a new chassis coming out for Le Mans,
which should be cool.
A few rounds down the road. 11th position, Shinya Nakano, Kanda Kawasaki.
Shinya. Boy, where do we start with Kawasaki? There's not a whole lot to be said. I'd love to see Kawasaki up front. I think everybody else has made not a quantum leap, but a good leap this year. And I think Kawasaki hasn't kept up.
Okay. And Shinya is probably, he's one of the better riders out there. You know, it's hard to grade when they're also good, but he's got a gobs of talent. He can do it, I think.
And it's, you know, the bike itself was down on speed as well.
Yeah.
They were basically about 5 to 6 miles an hour off of, or maybe 7, off the top end too. So, Maybe wind. Who knows? I forget what his finishing position was in Jerez. Do you remember?
No, off the top of my head, no, I do not.
Yeah. Yeah, Pop Monkey.
Exactly, I know.
Our MotoGP encyclopedia.
Yes, I just don't have the kind of brain to remember all that stuff, and it's, you know.
I get so dang excited about the next race that I practically forget the last one before.
Yeah, exactly. But that makes it fun to watch again, you know?
Yeah, it turns out who wins this. Yeah. It's like one of those favorite books you read three or four times. I have no problem with that.
Exactly. 12th position, Carlos Checa.
We talked about Checa before. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dunlops.
Yeah, I think
so. What are you
going to do? Exactly. And it looked like they were doing really well in the preseason. I think that was because they were, you know, the qualifying tires, things like that. So they can, although he didn't qualify all that well here, but you know, you're going to have tracks that are, you know, I don't want to suited for Dunlop. No, but how about, you know, not so less suited. And if Dunlop does put some of the effort and money into it, I think they can come up with a good tire. They really do so well in every other series that they have any competition.
No doubt. It makes you wonder what the real commitment is.
Yeah.
And I too would like to see multiple brands because, well, then again, hopefully we won't go in the World Superbike direction, but I don't think that'll ever happen in GP.
No, I don't think so either. I agree.
Not that I think that that's been a bad thing for World Superbike. I think it's been a great thing for World Superbike. But the more, the merrier.
Right. I think as long as they, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe one day there might have to be some sort of rules about tires so that you don't find the smaller teams No rules about tires. But no, you don't want it to end up where some guys, like you had in Superbike to an extent. But I do having the tire war going on is good for us. We do get a trickle down. Tires is one of the big areas where what happens in MotoGP eventually does work its way down in one way or another to the tires that you and I can go out and buy.
Absolutely. You know, standard DOT tires all the way up to race slicks that you can buy in the States. And elsewhere in the world, are obviously, and you'd expect it, some of the best tires, but the leaps and bounds have been made in the past few years have been amazing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's the tires are awesome. You can go buy a set of tires now that are the equal of you know, just the tires that you go buy, regular dot tires, are the equal of racing slicks for not long ago at all.
Not too long ago. All right, we're diverging. Moving on to James Ellison.
13th. Hey. You know, he had, out of 19 riders, he's in the points. He's got, 2 points. So, you know, that's good. I'm glad. It had to be getting a little old for James in testing every single time, just dead last.
Yep.
That's got to be discouraging. And, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel, maybe. He was still a good 12 seconds behind Checa. He's a minute off the off of Rossi. Which, you know, 22 lap race on a long circuit like that and everything. Well, you know, but at least he lapped, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. You know, I don't anticipate lappers so much this year.
No, I agree.
We've had it in the past, mm-hmm. and I have a feeling that the way everything's gone so far, but who knows, that it's going to consistently be that way, which is good for, I think, the race. Not that there's anything against lappers. I've been one myself back in the old day, but...
Yeah. It's, you know, it's a fact of life. I think it's bad in a situation in the AMA where you have, you know, basically moving chicanes. But even in MotoGP, the lappers were WCM, and Team Roberts last year was having a disastrous year, so that, you know, they were... And even then, it was never always super consistent. That you'd get like the one guy lapped, that kind of thing would be often how it would turn out. So I agree. I don't think it's a big problem. 14th place, Makoto Tomita. Hey, really wants those Bridgestones. He just, he did so well in 2004, you know, and I mean, comparatively he didn't, you know, but he did well.
He had flashes of brilliance. We haven't seen that this year, and let's hope we see some of it because I really like to see him go well.
Right, and I mean the team as a whole is a kind of a neat team, mm-hmm. and he's a good rider, a lot of talent. you know, often gets these cool leathers, the Spider-Man type of thing or whatever. Was that Melandri? Yeah. Whoever it was.
And yeah, it was Melandri. Who immediately crashed the bike.
Tomata had something, some kind of movie tie-in leathers too.
I think he did.
They were cool. But whatever. You know, he needs to be farther up the grid. He can do it. He's capable. And I mean, not to knock Ellison and Cheka and Nakano, but he should be finishing ahead of all of those guys on a Honda.
I agree. I think that they're just one of those teams that hasn't made the next step, hasn't made the step to 2006, is still mired in the past.
Yeah, that's possibly true. And
you look at the lap times from the previous year, and I think we'll see this at every track. Everybody's going faster. It'll be very interesting next year to see what happens when we go to 20% less or whatever. I'm going to diverge here for a moment. Well, maybe okay. I should save this for another time.
Diverge away. We can always edit it out if it gets boring.
It'll be very interesting next year, considering when you watch the 250 lap times at your average GP track, which are usually not that far off of the GP times. Let's say 5 to 7% less. To see what happens next year with the 800s, because I wouldn't be surprised unless they really pull, all the teams really pull a rabbit out of their hat. We're going to have to see what they do with that if both bikes aren't running about the same speed or the same overall lap time, not necessarily the same speed, because we, for the most part, I'm guessing the 250s probably have a little bit higher corner speed. But anyway, back on topic. Who's next?
Who is next on our thing? Yeah, you're breaking up there a little bit too. I was starting to worry, but I think it's clearing up. Having some internet fun. 15th position, Alex Hoffman, first of the Dantin Ducatis. Oops, there was some noise there, sorry. I don't know. He's a great guy. He finished the race. There you go. And
he got his first point of the season.
Yes.
They're down there. They're the WCMs this year. They're all on 2005 bikes, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right? Oh, I thought they got the 2006s or the customer spec, which was, yeah, basically it was, I think it was, I can't remember.
GP6 minus all the pretty bits, I suppose.
Something along those lines, yeah. In any case, it's definitely not the equal of the factory Ducati. And Dantin, not to knock them as a team, but they're not the equal of the factory Ducati team either in many ways. Money and I think, I've never been there, but just from what you see and the rumors that you read, which admittedly are rumors, they're a good team, but they're not going to be knocking on, the Grassinis and the Cito Ponzes. And as far as that of a team that is just like this sort of more of a feeder for, new talent, Dantin is almost like the, where the guys go when they can't get a job anywhere else.
it's the left pasture. Between him and Jose Luis Cardoso, who came in 16th, the last place, last finisher, they're not done, I don't think, putting a stamp, but in every GP season, you have the top tier teams and you have the bottom tier. And I'd like to see Dantin pull something out. Because I don't like filler in a race, but they need to create some results.
Right, exactly. And they, and I mean, it is a race. Somebody wins and somebody's last. It's just the way life is. And, hopefully it won't be Dantin every time. And I don't think it will. I think they'll, there will be a mix of teams that are at the bottom.
Hoffman's a great rain racer, so we'll have to see happens when that comes around.
Doing a rain dance, and come Donington, I'm sure it'll be wet, and it always is. Non-finishers. First of all, not even finishing the first lap, Randy DiPugna on the Kawasaki.
Ouch.
Yes.
Well, maybe Max should have shown up. Yeah, he managed to scatter a couple of bikes, other bikes off course at the same time. One of the Ducatis, I'm not sure who it was, and I saw a great picture of that accident in progress, where Roberts pretty much looked like he was headed directly to his bike and making some serious evasive maneuvers. So we'll try and dig that out and put a link to that series because it was really cool.
Yeah, we'll see if we can find that on rideon2.com. And if I get a link, I'll link to it there. Then big disappointments. And we said we'd talk about this again in qualifying. And I'm sure, you know, if you've watched the results and paid attention, Vermeulen and Hopkins both out. Both Suzuki's out.
Lucky number 13.
Apparently. And
13 engines down in one single weekend. Bob mm-hmm. and I talked about this earlier before, wondering how many engines they actually had down there. Amazing.
Yeah.
And I personally can frankly understand Hopkins' frustration, which was shown to the world. Vermeulen just rather quietly rolled back into his pits, and they slammed the garage door, and that was it. But that's gotta hurt.
Exactly. And I mean, yeah, they, in fact, on the speed broadcast, they sort of neatly snipped out. I mean, you didn't even realize that Vermeulen was gone. And then you're sort of like, you know, they sort of said something in passing, and it was kind of like, well, yeah. And you watch the lap charts, and then when they finally showed him, hey,
there you go.
He's gone. And,
yeah,
and Hopkins was, you know, basically kicking the crap out of his motorcycle there on the side of the track. And yeah, it's got to be frustrating.
There were a lot of people that gave him grief for that. And I don't have the same feeling. I can really understand. 13 engines in a weekend. I don't know how many were John's, but let's just say half. He had 6.5 go.
Yeah.
That'll drive you nuts. And frankly, he was doing well in the beginning of the race. He was running well. He had some pretty good prospects. He seems to like Cutter. And it's just too bad for the team. And they... The problem is obviously, I think in this case, not rider-based, it's bike-based, and they need to fix that because I think they would have some success this year.
Yeah, I agree. They Hopkins got a lot of talent. He's also young, which, you know, will excuse somewhat the kicking the bike sort of thing, and I tend to agree with you that, you know, although you probably prefer these things not to be caught on camera, you know, it's not like he was, you know, kicking another rider, and
My thoughts exactly. He's kicking a piece of lovely painted carbon fiber over a pretty much dead motorcycle.
Right. Probably wasn't even kicking it that hard. It just looked like it was a little bit of, you know, a frustration thing. And the,
although it seemed rather well aimed at the Suzuki logo. So.
Uh-oh. And it does, and you hear the same story over and over again. How can Suzuki, a team that dominates AMA to an extent, and has done well in World Superbike.
Quite well.
Yes. How come they are doing so not that great in MotoGP? And it's just focus.
And that, and you got to remember that you're talking production engines, mm-hmm. which get a whole lot of testing, and prototype engines, which don't.
That's true. And I think that Suzuki had the history of the... contingency money in AMA, so they had fields full of testers, and yep. that had to help the and they probably did the same things in Canadian Superbike, Australian Superbike, you know, all those places. So you just have all these people out there testing your machine, and yeah, that's probably true. And so, you know, big disappointment to have both of your motorcycles retire, not crash out, just plain quit. And yep. You know, Hopkins did it, you know, blow up in a puff of smoke, or did it just sort of coast to a stop, or what? But he finished on the track. He couldn't even get back to the pits.
Hey, that's what he was mad about.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then,
at,
like,
least Vermeulen coasted back to his pits.
Right. And Vermeulen managed to get it to the garage. So, you know, that's got to be awful. But hopefully in Turkey, they'll sort some stuff out. And like Jim said, we were talking about it a little earlier, and I was skeptical about how much crap they bring. I mean, they, you know, this race was a long ways away, flyaway race. A lot of the stuff was shipped down on boats, not shipped in airplanes, before Jerez even. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, now they do fly in just tons of freight, but, you know, how many engines did Suzuki bring? And you know,
not enough.
Yeah, apparently not enough. Exactly. And, so it makes you kind of wonder. You know, you see picture these garages full of mechanics frantically cobbling together one good engine out of three blown up ones.
I cannot imagine that they had 13 engines there. But then again, you never know.
You never know. The budgets are astronomical. And if they know they have a problem, maybe they did, you know, uncreate another one.
But I can well imagine as well that those engines were so differing in performance and torque curves and whatnot, that was probably also really frustrating for both of those guys. Because every time you go out, it's almost like a different bike.
Yeah, that's probably true. It's not something I'd thought about, but you're right. With a with such a hand-built prototype engine, you probably do get inconsistencies between them as far as what's going on, huh?
Yep, indeed. And so I look for good stuff from both of those guys later this year. If I had to pick either one of them as somebody with real potential this year, I'd probably go with Vermeulen. I still think Hopkins is a real solid rider, and one day he's going to get his shot. But I think Chris is just like the rest of the rookies this year. They want to make their mark. So we'll see. We'll see. Another guy to come out of World Superbike and try and stamp his mark on GPs.
Exactly. And basically turn down a Honda ride, too.
Yep.
You know, which maybe he's regretting that. But he, I think he had reasons to go to Suzuki that we, you know, don't know now and may never know.
Well, think about it this way. You're big fish in a small pond, or, you know, that old analogy. He's right. A decent-sized fish, and, you know, between he and Hopkins, I think they can both put together a good program, development program, but they got to have the motor behind it.
That's true. Do you think they have something up their sleeve, you know, Suzuki as a team, something up their sleeve for the 800s? They've got two young guys.
I think all of the, all, you know, if these teams don't, they're doomed. If there's anybody that I'm sure does, it's going to be Honda. Their experience with so many different kinds of engines is just incredible, and they've probably been working on it ever since the announcement was made with the MSMA a couple of years ago. But yeah, Suzuki's probably got something baking. They've had a highly competitive for what, 17, 18, 19 years now, 750, the Gixxer 750, that's been a great bike in, you know, racing all over the world. So they can take that experience and match it directly across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I look to see that. It is going to be, it's going to be neat. And it actually, now that I, you know, every time I think about it, it pisses me off more that I'm not going to be at the Grand Prix this year. You know, the last chance to hear the 990cc MotoGP bikes.
I'll tape it for you.
There you go. It's the same thing, really. You know, I can watch it on TV. And
hey, I unfortunately wasn't able to make it last year, but Jules was at the race and would call me during practice and say, listen, swing the phone by as they went around. So
I haven't, and this is something for the podcast that I haven't mentioned yet, partly because I, you know, I hope it works, but I had a, I have set up a thing so I can call and do podcast blog entries, basically. So they'd be little short 5-minute updates throughout the race weekend, and it would be outside the normal feed. I was going to do, you know, MotoGPOD live or MotoGPOD on location or something like that, and just call from my cell phone, assuming it worked and that I could get a line out, and, you know, say whatever. So I don't know, you know, since I'm not going to be there, you know, we'll have to set that up. So maybe you can do that for us.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting because this year my plan, as in last year, was to corner work at USGP. But I'll definitely have plenty of time or downtime between races and practices. It's pretty cool. You're just going out, cleaning the track, checking the corners, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
So, yeah, that'll work.
And you corner work, when you do something like that, are you corner working every single time the guys go out on track? Every race, every practice? Or
every race, every practice, everything.
Okay. They don't have the shifts or something like that then, okay.
You might get a little bit of time off, but frankly, the cohesiveness, the cohesiveness of the corner working team is very important. And pretty much, at least, I'm guessing, half to three-quarter of the people that corner work are actually club racers, people that have a real good grip on the dynamics of what goes on in an incident, and understand what the timing is. But I mean, these are the corner workers for the USGP are very, very, especially at you know, the guys that captain the team are very experienced people in corner working, 20 years or more of experience. So, it works great.
Cool. And yeah, and you're not going to be there to go shopping or any of that kind of business. So, you know, I understand that it's
Yeah, you know, and it really is the best seat in the house, too. You don't have anything between you and the riders.
Right, for that one corner. But yes.
True, for that. Well, you find out a lot. And frankly, being that close is just absolutely amazing. Since I wasn't able to make it last year, it was kind of a drag. I was really looking forward to that. But I've done it for World Superbike there. A lot of people may remember, in I believe it was 2004, the Turn 1 crash with Aaron Yates coming up the inside and taking out Eric Bostrom and a whole mess of other people, including Hodgson. I picked up Hodgson's bike. It was light as a feather, and the guy was a nice guy. He said, "Hey, don't touch the muffler. It's really hot back there." I'm like, "You just crashed in a World Superbike race, and you're warning me not to burn my hand. Thank you very much."
That was nice of him. So, okay, well, in any event, even if you're not making calls on the cell phone, you definitely have some good stories afterwards of what happened that weekend, and that's something.
No doubt, good photos as well. Oh, yeah. My plan is to hopefully, if I can, sneak my cheap little video camera in there and just let it run during all the qualifying. So
cool. Okay. Well, all right. I think we kind of did our thing. We're probably running at about probably getting pretty close to an hour. Yeah, long time. I like to keep the race report short, but so much for that. And it was fun, Jim. I enjoyed talking with you. It's you know, it's nice to have somebody to bounce stuff off of. And one of my problems is I've been so busy these past few weeks, really, that I just, you know, something's got to give. And unfortunately, it's been my kind of immersion in MotoGP, you know, of spending every additional moment or whatever on the internet and scouring for information and stuff like that. You know, I'm spending time with my family. Work has been exceedingly busy, putting in a lot of hours. I've got Navy stuff going on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, the one of the breaking points has been that free time. So above and beyond the race, and it was nice to have somebody that you know, to, like I said, that was, has been paying attention and to bounce stuff off of, catch me in mistakes.
Hey, no problem. I enjoyed it too. Hopefully we'll be able to, or I'm sure we'll do it again.
I'm sure we will.
Hopefully we haven't bored the folks out of their skulls, and nobody hates me.
No, I'm sure you'll do fine. And I, unfortunately, we did have a few, just like just now, we had a terrible internet moment, which just kind of inexplicable, where all of a sudden the quality goes to hell. But, you know, we could hopefully still understand you. And so, well, yeah, we'll definitely be doing it again sometime. And I think we'll be seeing more Jim. And whatever, I think we're going to sign this show off. So thanks very much, Jim. It was fun.
Thank you.
Okay. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.